From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It was January of 2019 that WHQR started a year-long civil discourse experiment. We brought together about a dozen people, diverse in age, ethnicity, and political affiliation, to observe how the tone and quality of the group's conversation changed over the year. We also wanted to find out if these people would eventually value spending time together. We wanted to see if they could like each other, even though they disagreed on serious issues. That series, Beneath the Surface, had some deeply moving and surprising moments, and it had some spectacular failures. One colleague at the station likens the series to the early GarageBand tapes of civil discourse. Another colleague calls it the series that broke me. But I still find the book I relied on heavily during that process, which had just been published by a social scientist who's now at Harvard, that book still offers wisdom that is too easily skipped over or simply forgotten. And the lessons it explores, which the author did not invent, are required learning for a happy life. And if you worry about the future of this country, this interview with Arthur Brooks, New York Times bestselling author of Love Your Enemies, How Decent People Can Save America from the Culture of Contempt, is worth a listen. Just for a moment, put aside your cynicism. You can pick it up again as soon as this episode is over. Arthur Brooks is a social scientist who studies human happiness. He's the William Henry Bloomberg Professor of the Practice of Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School and Professor of Management Practice at the Harvard Business School. He's also the best-selling author of 12 books, and he's the creator of the popular How to Build a Life column for The Atlantic. This interview first aired in 2019. Arthur Brooks, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel. Wonderful to be with you.
It's great to have you with us. So before we get into what we've been doing with our Beneath the Surface group, help us understand, for those of us who are new to the idea of a contempt culture, what happens when we insult someone who disagrees with us and treat them with contempt or think about them with contempt?
Well, contempt is something that most people, they think of it as sort of interchangeable with hatred or even anger, but it's actually a pretty complex emotion. Imagine if you take anger and mix in disgust. Anger is actually a hot emotion that says, I care what you think and I want to change what you think. But when you mix in disgust, it turns ice cold. It basically turns into an expression of not caring or thinking that the other person is worthless. Contempt was defined by Arthur Schopenhauer, the great 19th century philosopher, as the conviction of the utter worthlessness of another person. And so it's almost a question that answers itself, doesn't it? When you treat somebody with contempt, you are saying, and we have a million ways to discern somebody else's contempt. When you treat somebody with contempt, you're saying you're worthless. You're not wrong. You're not even stupid. You're actually worthless, and what you're saying is worthless. This is one of the reasons that expression of contempt are the best way to predict when a couple is going to get divorced. They treat each other with contempt because it's almost a form of abuse to do that. And if citizens do that, if friends do that, if people living in the same country who owe each other a certain amount of respect treat each other with contempt, the results are predictable. You're going to get polarization and an inability to even discuss issues, forget civility, and to even be in the same room together.
Well, that does sound pretty terrible to decide that someone is worthless. But on the other hand, I know there are going to be people listening who say, but I'm a discriminating person, and there are just going to be people out there that I really don't want to engage with, I don't want to spend my time with. So why is contempt so terrible?
Well, to begin with, it's counterproductive. It's one of the things that I often ask audiences, because they'll say, well, you know, a lot of people deserve my contempt. I'll say, okay, you know, the people that you really strongly disagree with, you know, a lot of the people who are listening to us, I would say that if I were to guess, I'd say probably 80% of the people listening to us didn't vote for Donald Trump and didn't support him. I don't know that, but I'm just taking a wild stab at it. And they're really unhappy about the current state of American politics, and they have contempt for the people who are supporters of the president. Say, okay, fine. What do you want for those people? Would you like to exile them, kick them out of the country? Well, of course not. Would you like to put them in jail? Absolutely not. Would you like to hurt them? What kind of person do you think I am? What do you want? I want them to think and act differently. Well, how's your hatred working out to meet that goal? How well is that working out for you? When is the last time you insulted somebody into agreement? When was the last time you dismissed somebody and effectively said that they were worthless and said, you know, you have a very good point. I'm going to look at your point of view differently. You know, it's interesting. We all fall prey to this. I mean, the people who are listening to us today, you know, it's everybody's thoughtful about their point of view, but it's very easy in this culture of contempt where people are basically profiting from our hatred in media and in entertainment and especially in politics. You know, when you were reading my little biography, I bet people were saying, huh, yeah, interesting. Yeah, lots of books and et cetera. A conservative public policy think tank in Washington, I bet a bunch of people listening said, not going to listen to that guy. I'm not going to take that guy seriously. That's because we're in a culture of contempt. And you know, I might be the most reasonable person, but that kind of stains it. Is the minute that it's branded in a particular way. And if we were a predominantly conservative audience, the exact same thing would happen. This is not under one political viewpoint at all.
Right. And so how do you, although we do have a fairly diverse audience politically, I have to say it, you might even be able to make an argument that it's a little more diverse politically here than in larger markets.
Yeah, I believe it.
But
sure.
How do we find that line then between dismissing someone through contempt and continuing to be discriminating in not only our thinking, but also how we vet sources and how we let sources into our brains?
Well, to begin with, we have to remember what's most important. This has been a real epiphany for me because, you know, I have pretty strong political opinions, or I guess I used to have strong political opinions. My work on Love Your Enemies has kind of clouded my perspective on politics because it's helped me to understand that politics is so far down the line of what I consider to be important. And that, I guess that's my point. Remember what's the most important thing. That's relationships with other people. That's love. You know, when I talk to people who say, I haven't talked to my sister-in-law or my brother or my mother, God forbid, in however long, because the person is a Democrat, the person's a Republican, the person hates Trump or the person loves Trump, I say, are you kidding me? These political differences are more important than the love that you have for a family member? That is insane. That is a complete misordering of priorities. And so what I ask people to do is to remember, number one, what do you want the most? And we all want the same thing. We want to be happy and we want to have love in our lives. That's what we want the most. And if you say, I am uncompromising in that goal, it's amazing how it will reorient yourself toward the political conversations at hand. It's amazing when you basically even say, if there's somebody you disagree with strongly politically, you can even say, you know what, let's think together. When we order our priorities personally, how far down the list is politics? And it'll be like fifth. Say, okay, fine. So let's limit our conversation 10% politics and 90% of the stuff that matters the most. And you find that the relationship is regenerated, that the love comes back into the relationship. It's really healthy thing to do.
So you're talking about possibly finding and repairing some of these relationships that people would argue are important to them, primary relationships, familial relationships. But there's also an argument to be made for having relationships with people who maybe aren't family members, but who think differently than we think.
Right.
What is that argument? Why would I? Why wouldn't? Isn't it just more fun to hang out with people who think like you do?
Yeah, no, it's actually incredibly boring. Look, different strokes, right? And I've met a lot of people who basically never want to leave their neighborhood. Personally, you know, diversity for me is a real source of my happiness. You know, once I'm in a group of people that agree with me for too long, I'm getting the shakes. I'm ready to get out, you know, but everybody actually can be happier and better off if they're exposed to more difference in their lives. You just have to kind of get the hang of it. And it's actually really fun when you get used to it. When you become, anybody listening to us can become more of a specialist in loving people more who disagree with you, to being the person who's always trying to find an interesting point of view that's different than your own. I was talking to a college professor, a colleague of mine here at Harvard. I was having breakfast with him last week. Super nice guy, super smart guy. differs with me politically a lot. And before he said something, he said, like, I got to say something that's kind of controversial. I don't mean to cross any lines here. And I said, before you cross any lines, you got to understand there's no lines. You can tell me my mother wears combat boots. I'm not going to walk out of this breakfast because I don't care. I literally am not going to be offended by anything that you say. Just set up some rules for yourself as opposed to so many rules for other people. Life just becomes so much more interesting, so much more fun, and you have so much less fear because you're not afraid anymore that somebody's going to offend you because you're the one who decides whether you're going to be offended or not.
So that's interesting. That's a new wrinkle. You've made a rule then for yourself that you will not be offended. How do you do that?
Because sticks and stones, man. It's like one of these deals where, you know, we're blessed to live in a country where when somebody disagrees with you, you're not that worried they're going to take out a gun and shoot you. You know, it's simply disagreement. And when you decide that disagreement doesn't hurt you, that disagreement actually might make you stronger. And if in point of fact, you're wrong in something that you thought factually wrong, it's better to know first as opposed to last. You're going to go out in search of people who disagree with you, and you'll have more varied friendships and more varied conversations and relationships. That's something that you can decide to do if you feel safe. Now, part of the problem that we have in our society today is we've gone through a long period, a couple of decades actually, where there's been a kind of an exotic variant in how we think about politics. Where and policy issues and social issues, and this is especially true on college campuses, where we've said that speech is a form of violence, that you know, people, when they say something that you find offensive or marginalizing, that is equivalent to harming you physically. Well, that's a very dangerous way of thinking. You know, most of us don't share that point of view, and we have to remember that for most of us, if there's speech that bothers you, the answer is not less speech, the answer is more speech.
You're listening to Coastline. We're exploring America's culture of contempt with Arthur Brooks, author of Love Your Enemies, How Decent People Can Save America from the Culture of Contempt. Still to come, the impact of confirmation bias and how to connect with your ideological opposite. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, my guest is Arthur Brooks, Harvard professor and author of 11 books, including the bestseller Love Your Enemies, How Decent People Can Save America from the Culture of Contempt. It's a book I relied on heavily during the early days of Beneath the Surface, our year-long experiment in civil discourse, or perhaps it's something deeper now. And today, we're hearing from Arthur Brooks and exploring how our group of 11 diverse citizens might go deeper in their practice, in perhaps going beyond what we call civil discourse. Now, Arthur Brooks, just a few minutes ago, you talked about how politics has dropped in importance for you. But you spent a lot of time in Washington, and you worked with politicians at the federal level. How interested were those folks in learning some of these principles and practicing them?
They were a lot more interested as people than they were as politicians. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we have a tendency to do with everybody, but especially with our politicians, is to kind of objectify them, to see them as nothing more than political animals. And one of the great privileges of my career has been to get to know and become close friends with a lot of our federal officials, you know, the people that are in the Senate and the House in particular. And to know them as people, and you know, they're just like us. The problem is they don't know how to get out of the handcuffs of the current culture of contempt. They don't know how to do it. And so kind of running effectively master classes in the art of solidarity and dignity and love was, as far as I'm concerned, one of the most satisfying and interesting things I was ever able to do with politicians and public officials in Washington, D.C. And for me, it just helped me remember what's most important in my life, or the my faith and my family and my friendships and work that I think serves other people. I mean, politics comes and goes. It's kind of like the weather. And by the way, you know, politics really is like the weather insofar as that everybody talks about it, whether they're very well informed or not. My work in Washington was about ideas. Ideas are like the climate. You know, I was trained, I have a PhD in policy analysis. I'm a kind of a climate scientist. And so it's really dumb if you take a climate scientist and say, just read the weather report. That's not the highest and best use. And so that was another reason that I just found that politics became less and less important to me personally as the years went by.
And when it comes to dealing with federal officials, I mean, this is one of the reasons that we started our civil discourse group here, because I have a theory that nothing is going to change on Capitol Hill until citizens change first, until citizens reach a point where they won't tolerate a certain kind of public discourse. And so, as you say, you had a hard time helping the politicians find a way to get out of the handcuffs. And you're talking about the handcuffs that prevent them from compromising or having actual dialogue.
Yeah, you know, that's right. And, you know, it's I think you're exactly right on this whole what comes first, the supply or the demand for brotherly love in our country. And the answer is absolutely the demand. When we live in a democratic capitalist system, both in democracy and capitalism are market-driven phenomena, which is to say the customer is king. When it looks like citizens don't want you to get along with your adversaries, you won't. You can count on having candidates that are populist and polarizing on both the Democratic and Republican Party. I mean, obviously that was the case for the Republicans last time, and you look at the debate stage on the Democratic side, and it's like, wow. It's kind of the same thing, but on the other side, well, because they're getting the signals. They believe that their base, if not the rest of us, I mean, you and I are not in the base. If you were in the base, you wouldn't be doing this incredibly important work. But you know, when they're hearing from their base that they want polarization, they want populism, they want contempt, they will deliver.
Right.
And that's the problem. We have to tell them to stop delivering, but that requires a social movement.
So then can you just take us through a quick run through of who benefits from this division so we can really start to understand it from beyond ourselves?
Yeah, for sure. And this is the part that really animates me because, you know, when I first started the research on this, you know, I was sort of bummed out about how negative everything was and how much we were missing opportunities to love each other and all that. And I thought, well, you know, maybe I'm just like in the minority. But then I looked at the data, I'm not in the minority. Right. You know, we're the 93%, to adopt the old kind of language from a few years ago. How do I know? Because 93% of Americans, this comes from Tim Dixon's polling work, that 93% of Americans say they hate how divided we become as a country. Now, that means 7%, however, don't hate it. You know, the other 7% don't hate it. They're literally willing to say, I don't hate it, I like it. Why? Because they're profiting from it in some way. They're getting money or power or fame or just satisfaction and clicks and social media followers through the polarization. Well, the 7% shouldn't be in the cockpit. You know, look, this is our country. And we all have neighbors and friends. I mean, if I basically ask all of our listeners right now, everybody listening to us, how many of you or do you love somebody with whom you disagree politically? Every single person listening to us right now is like, yeah, I do.
Right.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I have attenuated relationships with them, but I love some people who disagree with me politically. Well, don't let some guy on MSNBC or Fox News or in the White House or in the Congress or any place tell you that you should hate your neighbor or that you should hate your family member. It's not right. And it's hurting you. It's helping him or her. It's hurting you. So refuse to be used.
Right. Now, let's talk about this in practice, because in the beginning of your book, you liken addiction to contempt to a meth addiction. And it is an emotional habit, and it is something that people have to be conscious of. And you also talk about creating a rule for yourself about not being offended. That sounds to me like a similar idea in terms of being aware all the time of your emotional life while you're engaging with other people and being conscious enough to make decisions about things as it's happening to you or through you.
Yeah, for sure. It's so, like, you know, go ahead.
Well, how do you work against what has, for many of us, become a habit?
Yeah. So it's like the way that you break any habit. It's basically at first, I would have to say, look, my name is Arthur and I'm a contempt addict. Hi, Arthur. You know, it's practically a 12-step program. You know, you have to actually look at the fact that there's a lot of stuff, a lot of emotions that you're experiencing that they feel like they're kind of out of your control. They trigger you all over the place, and that it's not what you want. You want a better future. And it's actually worth pointing out that this has some neurological roots that are pretty familiar to those who have studied the addiction literature or who know anything about addiction. What happens with almost any addiction is that the brain feeds dopamine, which is a neurotransmitter that involved in desire, in focus, intense pleasure, and it floods a part of the brain called the nucleus accumbens. The nucleus accumbens is a very ancient part of the brain that was developed. Evolved more than a million years ago, much, much earlier than the prefrontal cortex that gives us our consciousness, you know, what we think of as our own personalities. And when the nucleus accumbens is hit with dopamine, it intensely wants something that has been formed into habit. Sometimes those things are drugs and alcohol, very intense, as we all know. It can ruin your life. But sometimes it's things that are as simple as the way that you communicate with other people. If saying, you know, the president's an idiot, gives you on Facebook, gives you a tiny squirt of dopamine in your nucleus accumbens that will reinforce a pattern, a habitual behavior. The only way to beat a habit is to basically say, when I get that desire to do something, I have to stop before I do it. It's actually breaking habits is it's hard, but it's simple. You have to stop and become conscious. You have to involve your prefrontal cortex at the moment of the stimulus in habitual behavior. So if you want a cigarette, the way to break your cigarette addiction is not through sheer willpower. It's simply to stop when you want a cigarette and then consciously simply do something else in its place. You know, go for a walk, take a drink of water, and it'll be hard, but that will start to reprogram your nucleus accumbens. Now, and one of the things I talk about in the book is when you have a desire, you're stimulated to say, to roll your eyes when somebody says something you think is misguided, to send a hateful Facebook post, to say the president's an idiot, whatever it is that you do that expresses contempt, you stop. And you do something instead. And what I recommend doing is what your heart really desires, which is actually to express love. You don't have to express love to the president, by the way. I'm not trying to, you know, drive the listeners crazy and, you know, turning off their radios right now. I mean, you don't have to do that because that's an abstraction. But to express love towards someone or something or toward yourself at that moment. This is very Buddhist. The Dalai Lama and I have worked on this together, believe it or not. I have a long-standing collaboration with His Holiness. And he
Oh,
says in the.
this is more than a one-time meeting with the Dalai
Oh,
Lama.
we've been together for 7 years.
Wow, okay.
For sure. We've written together in the New York Times and Washington Post, and we've collaborated on a bunch of things, including a film that we actually have together on Netflix right now called The Pursuit. And so he's been a great moral teacher to me over the course of this collaboration. I said one time, Your Holiness, what do I do in the moment when I feel contempt? He says, choose an expression of warm-heartedness. And I'm like, you know, you got anything else? But then I thought, you know, this is because it sounds sort of weak, but it's not. You know, weak people, when they feel hatred, answer with hatred. When they're treated with hatred, answer with hatred. Really strong-willed people, when they're treated with hatred or they feel hatred, they choose an expression of love. This is true. This is like Buddhist monk mastery. This is the highest level of self-mastery that one can get, is to actually answer with love no matter what you feel. And what is funny, I asked him, Your Holiness, what if I don't feel love? And he says, fake it.
The Dalai Lama is an advocate of fake it till you make it. Okay. Okay. So then, what do we do when we feel outrage over the point of view that someone has expressed? Because as you talked about, contempt is a complex emotion, and anger often comes first. So the contempt is something of a protective reaction. Is that a fair characterization of it?
Yeah, you put trust, and because you basically say, I'm writing this person off, but we do it insanely often and with the slightest provocation at this point, because the nucleus accumbens is driving our buses.
Right.
You know, and we got to get the prefrontal cortex back into action by choosing the right reaction when we feel these things. And in virtually all of the cases, we have no call to dismiss somebody as worthless. We have no call to do that. And so if we actually basically choose to say, you just can't offend me. I'm Superman. I'm a Buddhist master or whatever. You can't offend me because it's just words. You're not going to shoot me. I may not like how your vote or your opinion is changing my country, but right now I'm simply not under threat. This is a simulacrum. It's a simulation of threat. See, people when they're being driven to express contempt even without thinking about it, part of the reason is because they're stimulated and they feel fear, but the fear is inaccurate. It's an overestimate of the threat. And so you have to own the threat response by thinking about it clearly. And one of the ways to do it is by setting up rules. I'm just not going to feel fear and threat. I'm simply not going to act offended when somebody says something I disagree with.
But outrage can be part of this. A person, for instance, abortion is such a great kind of focus for discussion because people feel so strongly about it on all sides. If a person, for example, believes that abortion is murdering a human, then it's understandable that they would feel rage talking about allowing abortion at all. If you believe abortion is a very difficult choice, but is the right of any woman who has the right to self-determination, then you could feel rage when someone tries to take that right away. So given that kind of a circumstance and that kind of an issue that is so deeply emotional for people, where would you advise them to take it?
I would advise them to remember the humanity of the person who has the opposite point of view. Because, you know, in point of fact, this is not settled as a public policy or as a legal issue in the United States. I realize that a lot of people on both sides want it to be settled once and for all, but it's not going to be settled as long as we're a 50-50 nation on this. It's just not going to be. And you can basically say, okay, well, I want California to split off and become its own country where it becomes a settled issue, but this still won't be then. You know, we have to recognize that just because we have really, really strong views on this, the outrage is completely unproductive. On the contrary, it's counterproductive. The more that you're outraged and insulting about people on the other side, I mean, nobody, if you're pro-life, nobody's going to say, you know, you're right, I am a baby killer. I'm really going to reconsider my point of view. You know, or, you know, it's like, well, you want to subjugate women and keep them barefoot and pregnant. There's no pro-lifer in America who's going to say, oh, I guess you really do understand me. You got my number. Okay, let's talk. It's just not going to happen. And so as a result, what you're doing is you're being a baby through this outrage. You're basically saying, I'm not going to get my way, but I'll do anything I have to do to express my opinion because the expression of my outrage is more important than the other person. It's more important than the dialogue. It's more important than understanding each other. And it's more important than even having a shot at convincing somebody of my point of view. Well, that's incredibly self-indulgent.
So then let's look at this through the lens of what we're calling civil discourse. And I'm not sure. Are you calling civil discourse itself something of a pitifully low bar for human interaction? Or are you talking about just what we think of as civil discourse? Help us understand that.
It's a good question.
Because I've had own thoughts about this during the process, by the way. So I'll let you unpack that, and then let's talk about the group.
Yeah, you know, I think I may have changed my view on this since I wrote the book. So when I wrote the book, I basically said the problem with civility is it's a garbage standard. There's nothing wrong with civility, but it's the wrong standard. So civility is good, but the standard's wrong.
Right.
You know, if I basically said, hey, Rachel, my wife Esther and I, we're civil to each other, you'd be like, dude, you need counseling right now. It would be, you know, get yourself to a psychiatrist or a psychologist because that's your marriage is not functional if you're basically saying we're civil.
Right.
Or if I told you that my employees tolerate me and say I have a huge, you know, human resource problem on my hands. And so as a standard, you know, trying to live up to the standards of civility, I think it's too low a standard, even though I'm all about civility. Here's why I'm thinking about it a little bit differently. I have a colleague here at Harvard named Danielle Allen, who's really a political philosopher, first rate, very brilliant. And she, you know, we were talking about this on stage in an event. She said, you know, Aristotle talked about the importance of political friendships. And political friendships are kind of good enough friendships, mm-hmm. so that we can get stuff done and we don't blow each other up. You know, so they're not outraged, red-faced, you know, spittle-flecked arguments.
Right.
But they're not like, look, I agree with you and I love you so much I want to go out and, you know, I want to name my next child after you. It's not like that. It's basically good enough. It's a political friendship in which we can be civil to each other. We can find a way to compromise with each other. And so she really believes that the civility standard maybe is good enough. So I don't know. What's your view?
So you're saying there's value in that, certainly. And there are different purposes and relationships and levels of friendship. But as we embarked on this project, in the beginning, no one in the group knew each other before we started. And as they've gotten to know each other, we've watched their conversations get deeper. And actually engaged the assistance of a facilitator from a national nonprofit called Better Angels.
Those guys are great.
Yeah. And what was interesting, our group walked away from that exercise saying, this is kindergarten for us. We're so far beyond this. We can go much deeper than that. And I heard from a couple of people from Better Angels that what we're doing is what they call the alliances part of their program. That's the ongoing, you know, we're past the not calling each other names. But I think it's easy to be in mixed company and hold your fire and be polite and smile and nod and listen. And then when you're with your tribe again, go after the other side with contempt and ridicule and all the ugly things we talked about. And I think the bigger challenge for people is to really find actual respect in those other folks.
I agree. That's very well put.
You're listening to Coastline. Harvard professor and author Arthur Brooks is with us today. When we come back from this break, more on America's culture of contempt and what regular folks can do about it. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It's a conversation with Arthur Brooks, Harvard professor of the practice of public leadership and author of 12 books, including Love Your Enemies, How Decent People Can Save America from the Culture of Contempt. This book came out just after we had started a year-long experiment in civil discourse called Beneath the Surface. That series in 2019 brought together about a dozen people of different ages, races, and political leanings. You may remember that starting in January 2019, we set out to discover whether a diverse group of regular folks could learn to not only listen to people with other points of view, but actually come to value those other points of view, genuinely value them, without necessarily changing their own positions, which is part of Arthur Brooks' message in Love Your Enemies. So, Arthur Brooks, this exercise that our group engaged in August with a facilitator from Better Angels turned out to be elementary for them. Our group members first had a hard time deciding if they were red or blue. And one person joked, you know, Rachel has a room full of moderates now, which is not how she started. And that was funny and perhaps partly true. But what do we do when we get into hard conversations and we have members of the group who are ready and eager to engage? There's certainly respect and I think even affection that has grown among these folks. But what do we do when other people just quietly opt out?
Yeah, and it's sort of the same. Actually, it's the same question. What when people are just are incredibly intransigent, mm-hmm. when they can't get past the hostility that they have on a particular issue, and so they won't abide by. See, you know, what you were saying at the end of the last segment was really interesting. It's basically the civility norm is a great way to start the conversation because it gets past the name calling, and then it will quickly escalate into love. If you let it, but you have to actually start with a civility. It's funny. It's like civility is the gateway drug to affection.
Escalate into love.
Yeah. And I really like that a lot because I think that matches my experience. But, you know, the truth is you can't reach everybody. You know, there are some people who are really guarded for lots and lots of reasons. I mean, there are people who are walking around with a lot of scars, not about politics, but politics is an expression of a lot of the trauma and hurt that we have as people. And, you know, let's not fool ourselves into thinking that, you know, this exercise in civility escalating into love is going to meet everybody and solve all of our problems. You know, our political problems, once again, I think that they are, and I think that they are an expression of a lot of the deeper problems that certain individuals certainly have and even our society has. In a democratic capitalist culture, politics is downstream from culture. And so if you have problems with your culture, you're going to see problems with your politics, and conversations are going to help some people, but not everybody. One of the things that I recommend in these cases, I mean, I talk an awful lot about, you know, why would you choose unilaterally to love when other people are hating? Because it sounds like, you know, I hear this all the time, you know, why would I, this is like nuclear disarmament, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. Let's just give up our nukes and then see what happens. Well, in national security, that can be crazy because if you give up your nukes and the other side is like, ha ha, you're now unprotected. Why would you do that emotionally in a time of real political or ideological conflict? And the answer is because it doesn't work like international nuclear detente. It's not a good analog at all. When you choose to love, you will change one heart guaranteed, and that's your own. You really will, but you have to recognize that that's what you're in for. Sometimes you'll change the other person's heart too. The problem is that we're too focused on changing the other person's heart when we show love. You should be focused on changing your own heart and then just hoping for the best, because it's a win. I mean, it's not like you end up behind because your heart softened. You're ahead no matter what under the circumstances. And if the other person didn't give, the other person didn't change, if the other person wasn't reacting in the way that you wanted the person to react, or if God forbid the person laughs at you and say, sucker, ha ha ha, you still win. Mm-hmm. You do, because when you love, you come out ahead. You've made yourself happier. I mean, I've got the data in this book that shows that when you show love, you will change your brain chemistry. You will it will stimulate your brain to produce a hormone called oxytocin that will bond you to other people. It will make you into a better person. You'll like yourself better. So it's worth doing under the circumstances. And the other person reciprocates all the better. If they don't, too bad. Move on.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the challenges that I've had in moderating this group is when we get into a policy discussion, you know, abortion advocacy, or I should say anti-abortion advocacy versus abortion rights, or when we talk about public education policy, we get into fact-checking issues. Now, if I was talking with two elected officials or policymakers of some kind, I would be fact-checking them throughout the conversation. That would be my job. But to be fact-checking traffic cop with a group of citizens not only impedes the flow, it doesn't seem to serve what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. But I've noticed that people come to the table with pretty divergent sets of facts, many of which would be mutually exclusive if they were in fact facts. So we get back to the issue of news sources and how people are learning about these issues in the first place. And this is just, it feels like a kind of a rat's nest to me, it seems like to solve this part of the problem among regular citizens, you almost have to start some sort of educational program on news consumption.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. And of course, how do you do that? You know, how do you do that when all of the incentives in politics and all the incentives in media are going exactly the other direction? You know, the truth is that it's funny, you know, I've been looking, I'm working on a column right now about trust in institutions. And trust in institutions started to fall apart in the late 80s and early 90s. So it was before Newt Gingrich. It was before, certainly before the current era. But, you know, everybody sort of charts things back to 1994 when things started to go haywire. It was actually before that when trust in media sources started to fall apart. Trust in Congress fell apart. Trust in the federal government really started to fall apart. Came back briefly after 9/11, but then it deteriorated after that to even lower levels. And the question is why? What's going on? And I'm almost entirely certain that it's just the incentives to give people what they want. But when you sort of sycophantically kiss up to listeners or viewers or voters, they will reward you, but they won't trust you. And so we're kind of in this vicious cycle.
Really? So are you saying then the base viewers for Fox News and MSNBC don't trust those sources that they keep going back to?
That's correct. That's correct. You know, the people, I mean, people, there's a lot of people, you know, I was just reading a very interesting paper. This is what I do for fun as a social scientist. I was reading a paper on how much couples lie to each other. And you'll find that on sort of intimate statements of life and love, one in three statements for couples that are dating are a lie.
No.
One in 10. Yeah. One in 10 for married couples is a lie. So by the time you get married, there's more trust. And one of the reasons you got married is because there's a basis for trust. But there's just tons of lying that's going on among couples that are dating, but they're not married yet. It's really problematic. You know, you basically, you love this person. You want this person to tell you these things, even though you know that a lot of what this person is telling you is actually a lie. Well, that's kind of the dysfunctional or codependent relationship we have with a lot of the news media today and we have with a lot of our politicians today. Just tell me what I want to hear. Do I actually trust you? No. Am I better informed? Not really. I'm going to use any information I can when I'm an adversarial conversation. I'm going to throw out what I heard on MSNBC or, you know, some conspiracy theory or on Fox or, you know, on something I heard on talk radio or, God forbid, something that somebody's passing around on Facebook from some fringy website. I will actually use that, but I don't even trust it. So we're in a very, very bad cycle of low trust. We don't even trust our friends at this point.
Right. So these unvetted and these irresponsible so-called news sources are everywhere. They're on multiple platforms, as you mentioned. We now know Russia is actually involved in promoting conspiracy theories among Americans in order to divide them.
Right.
So given this ocean of non-facts out there, how do you have a conversation with someone who subscribes to one of these dubious sources?
It's a really difficult thing. I don't know. I mean, you've been doing it and I've been trying to do it. What have you found actually helps?
Personal stories. I mean, I try to get people to talk about their position on an issue. And then instead of talking to us, our group, about all the facts and the research that supports that position, I ask them to tell me about the first time they remember having an opinion on it and maybe tie it to a personal event in their life. We try to stay away from the data battles.
Yeah, the data battles, which are actually just propaganda battles at this point. I think it's a very good point, because one of the ways to bring people together is the truths that they have in common. You know, when I bring people together and I want to start a conversation and it's going to be about something that's controversial, and I have to do this a lot in my work, the first thing that I do is to ask them to tell each other about their kids. And the best ones are when they have teenage kids, because it's all complaints, and it's the same complaints. They bond, and they just have this, like, wow, you really understand me. And so most of the differences will tend to, they won't forget the oxytocin release that came from the eye contact, from sharing the, you know, the shared struggle of being in, like, yeah, your foxhole is the same as mine. We both have teenage kids and they're a nightmare. And, you know, that kind of thing. It's very interesting and fun. But it's the personal stories, and then what you're doing, you're connecting the idea of personal stories and what neuroscientists call brain-to-brain coupling, where literally wave the brain waves start to mimic each other when you tell personal stories on the issue itself. I think Rachel, I think you're right on. You're onto something really important to use that technique as opposed to, you know, what did you hear on Alex Jones? What did you hear from Rachel Maddow? You know, these people are not in the business of actually giving you accurate, balanced arguments.
Are there any sources that you, I mean, how do you find facts? Yeah, and, you know, certainly you're a social scientist, and so you vet your sources in a certain way. But what would you tell regular folks about finding facts and getting news?
Well, it's funny because a lot of people say we ask that question, but they don't want it. So, and so the what are the fashionable areas of research these days is among social psychologists who say you basically cannot beat confirmation bias. Mm-hmm. Confirmation bias is a phenomenon in which you reject facts that are contrary to your point of view as unreliable, but you accept just absolutely willingly, perhaps gullibly, so-called facts that support your point of view. And it's a normal human phenomenon. There's all kinds of evolutionary psychological reasons to do that. But the problem is that it makes it hugely difficult in an environment today where we're just there's facts that are flying at us all the time. And so psychologists, they're very fatalistic about saying that you can't get beyond confirmation bias. It's almost impossible with fact-based language to inform a population such that we can come together around shared facts. We're on the alternative facts universe. I'm not nearly as fatalistic about that, but I have to say that people will not expose themselves in any willing fashion to facts that seem to contradict their point of view if they feel like they're under threat or they feel like they're under siege. They have to feel a lack of fear. They have to feel accepted. They have to feel heard. And once somebody feels, dare I say, loved, they're willing to hear a different point of view. And it's amazing how conversion works. It's when people feel loved, they're willing to hear somebody else's point of view, and then they will represent it from the person who loves them to somebody else and defend it. It's an interesting process.
Yeah. You're listening to Coastline today. It's a conversation with Arthur Brooks, Harvard professor of the practice of public leadership and author of 11 books, including Love Your Enemies, which came out just after we started our year-long experiment in civil discourse called Beneath the Surface. He's with us via Skype today. Arthur Brooks, in your book, Love Your Enemies, you talk about demographic characteristics and say they shouldn't be dismissed, but we should exercise caution in using them as a source of bonding identity. And this issue has come up for us. Some people say, I don't see color. Others say, if you're not seeing color, you're not seeing me. And you could substitute LGBTQ for color or male, female, or European, Asian, American. How do we ensure that we do see people fully? And is that part of loving them?
Well, I think it is. And part of the problem is not that we see each other, we have demographic cardboard cutouts of people, but that we make ourselves into demographic cardboard cutouts by satisfying basic demographic what questions about ourselves and not digging into why. We're very bad at explaining the why, the moral purpose of what we do. I mean, we don't have the vernacular for it. We haven't practiced it. In many cases, we don't even know the why of our own lives. And so the result is we will settle for demographic identities of ourselves. But basically, these are symbols of ourselves to a very large extent. And I understand that these demographic characteristics, they might represent a whole bunch of things, to be sure, but we have to be able to articulate those things as well. If we don't, we miss the opportunity to change people's minds, to open people's hearts. You know, people want to talk to other people. They don't want to have a bunch of, you know, blockades put up to having a conversation. So basically, since you're a different race than me, you cannot understand me. Well, we're done at that point. Anybody who makes that argument has basically eviscerated the possibility of persuading anybody of anything, of enlightening anybody of anything. And so it's a big mistake when we use that tactic, when we create demographic identities for ourselves. That's the reason I rail against it.
And that's the time we have, that's this edition of Coastline. The book is Love Your Enemies, How Decent People Can Save America from the Culture of Contempt. Arthur Brooks, what a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Rachel. Thank you for your important work.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Jonathan Furnell engineered this episode. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. You can find this episode at whqr.org, where you can also find the Beneath the Surface series or subscribe to the podcast. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.